KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Benicia.
Sunset District.
I live in Lakeside.
The Western Addition.
Diamond Heights.
Emeryville, California.
Westwood Park.
Coming up, coming soon to a parking lot near you, self-driving buses.
And one of the guys jumped out in front of the vehicle, and the vehicle stopped.
Then we'll hear from an artist who makes installations to start conversation.
We got this artwork, which gave us a very difficult questions, and then what do we need to do?
And we'll meet a photographer who uses silhouettes to challenge cultural stereotypes.
You know, when you look at art history, you know, it's rare to see a black woman in a position on the wall of power.
Art that gets you thinking and talking. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. We hear so much in the news about driverless cars. It seems like any day now they're going to take over the streets. But an actual vehicle without human backup at a steering wheel is hard to find. One of the only places you'll see one is a parking lot in San Ramon, where robot buses are being tested today. KALW's Eli Wertschafter takes us there.
All right, can we load the next group of people on? Hop on board.
I've just stepped into a boxy red shuttle, along with a bunch of other reporters. We're going to ride in a circle around an empty parking lot. And I am stoked.
Okay, I'm about to take my first ride in an autonomous vehicle.
We're in a place called Bishop Ranch, a sprawling office complex in San Ramon. 30,000 people work here. And in a few months, some of them could ride around the property in this shuttle.
Here we go.
The doors swing shut and the electric engine kicks into gear. Last year, Governor Jerry Brown signed a law clearing the way for the first totally driverless vehicles on California roads. But if you want your own driverless car, you're gonna have to wait. Cause that law only applies to this one pilot program here at Bishop Ranch. Riding the shuttle feels pretty much like riding a normal bus, except of course for one thing.
I believe the main difference with a normal bus is that there is no driver.
Marion Leritier is a spokesperson for the French company Easy Mile. They've deployed this shuttle to more than a dozen other countries. She says in those places, riders have felt very comfortable.
I wouldn't say people are scared. They are all saying that the ride is really smooth and really quiet and they don't feel afraid at all.
But to feel safe, you have to put your trust in the machine. The shuttle has no steering wheel, no brake pedal, and nowhere for a driver to sit. Instead, an attendant stands on board with us, wearing a reflective safety vest. Leritier explains that if necessary, the attendant can take over and steer with what looks like a set of two video game controllers.
When it is on a manual mode, we are just plugging a remote, and then there is two joysticks, one to go front or back, and one to go left or right.
But ideally, that would never happen. The bus just follows a pre-programmed route. In this case, it takes us in a loop around the parking lot. We're going just 10 miles per hour. So if the shuttle sensors detect anything in our path, it will brake automatically.
All right, this is our stop.
In the balance between safety and convenience, it seems like this shuttle errs on the side of safety.
We hosted some people out here the other day, and one of the guys jumped out in front of the vehicle, and the vehicle stopped.
This is Randy Iwasaki, executive director of the Contra Costa Transportation Authority, a partner in the shuttle program. Of course, it's great the vehicle will stop for pedestrians, but Iwasaki says another time it braked because a plastic bag flew in front of it.
So to me, it's aggravating slow in some perspective because it's so safe.
So what's the point of a shuttle that goes slower than a normal bus, still needs an operator on board, and stops for plastic bags? Well, the owners of the Bishop Ranch Office Park take pride in having cutting-edge technology. CEO Alexander Marin paid $500,000 to bring the two shuttles here.
I don't have any investment in any aspect of this program. We're not trying to make a profit off of this. We're trying to provide a public good.
Marin says that by late summer, employees will use these shuttles to get to their offices from bus stops and parking lots.
The shuttle will pick them up and deliver them to the front door of the building. kind of like Disneyland.
And then in a later phase of the program, the shuttle could also pick up residents in the surrounding neighborhood. But getting to that point is an uphill battle. Current California law requires that self-driving cars have a brake pedal and a steering wheel. So the legislature had to pass an exemption just to get this pilot program off the ground. And now Iwasaki says there's still more work to be done before they're actually allowed to use public roads.
We have legislation, but we need a permit from DMV.
Even driving the whole length of Bishop Ranch, that requires permits from state and federal agencies.
And really, it's just crossing from one parking lot to another. That's a public street.
The crew at Bishop Ranch hasn't applied for those permits yet, but Iwasaki says they've been talking with regulators.
It takes a lot of effort to get a vehicle to cross the street.
All this effort, a new law, two sets of permits, months of testing, and hundreds of thousands of dollars, just for this one tiny pilot program with two buses. That could be frustrating for super fans of driverless cars. But Steven Schladover, a transportation engineer at UC Berkeley, says tests like this one should go slowly and carefully.
I think it's essential that the government regulatory agencies be very cautious in how they approach this.
Schladover says that today's automated systems are still nowhere near as safe and reliable as human drivers. Because, he says, believe it or not, humans are good at driving.
Obviously, we have lots of crashes, we have lots of fatalities, but the amount of driving that people do is so huge.
In that context, crashes are rare. In the U.S., a fatal crash happens about once every 100 million miles of driving. Can a computer necessarily do better? Schladover says, imagine your laptop going that long without glitching out.
Because if the computer that was driving that vehicle gave you the little hourglass symbol or the little spinning blue donut, you crashed.
Schladover has ridden a bunch of shuttles like the one in San Ramon. And he says every time he's gone on a real-world test, the attendant had to take over the controls at some point. He remembers one time when a shuttle got stuck for more than 2 minutes at an intersection full of cars, bikes, and pedestrians, unable to move forward.
And eventually the operator had to take over, had to ring a bell, and had to bring out a video game console to control the movements of the vehicle to actually inch it forward through the crowd of other road users.
So he gives one of the more conservative estimates out there about when most cars will operate without a driver inside.
And it's probably not going to happen maybe for the next 50 to 100 years.
50 to 100 years? Wow. Okay, well, if it's going to take that long, I think I should steal another ride while I have the chance.
All right, here we go.
From inside the shuttle, I can see the street on the other side of the parking lot. It seems like it would be so easy just to cross it, but we're not there yet.
Thanks a lot.
It feels like riding into the future, very slowly. At Bishop Ranch, I'm Eli Werchafter for Cross Currents.
What transportation stories do you want us to cover? Let us know at transportation@klw.org.
I saw you riding around in your brand new automobile. Yes, I saw you riding around, baby, in your brand new automobile.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. If you take a stroll around your neighborhood in Oakland, Berkeley, or San Francisco this summer, you might happen upon a Japanese tea house that wasn't there before. It's part of a mobile art installation by Taro Hattori called Rolling Counterpoint, where he engages guests in conversation around social issues like immigration, exclusion, or homelessness, all over steaming cups of tea. The project was developed while Hattori was in residence at the Montalvo Art Center, where there's a permanent version of the tea house he created. KALW's Jen Chien spoke with both Hattori and Montalvo Art Center's associate curator, Donna Conwell, about how this art installation is starting conversation. So Taro, you talk a lot about using conflict and dissonance in your work, and let me read a quote from your artist statement. With my work, I try to create an environment where viewers experience inner conflicts in their mind. So for example, you make sculptures that look like they can fly, but they're actually super heavy, or you've made pieces about pretty tragic historical events that might have some element of lightness or humor or playfulness to them. So what is it that you're trying to evoke in your audience?
I really want them to deal with any issues they have by themselves, not trying to find the answer, or from me, not trying to give answer to them. Many people ask me, okay, what is the agenda?
What's the point of this?
What is the point of this? And what's the result of this? What do we get out of it? So we got this artwork, which gave us such very difficult questions. And then what do we need to do? So that's the beginning of coming up with a solution, or the conversation, at least, between people who have different opinions, I think.
I think you were also thinking somewhat about your identity as an immigrant in the U.S., in relation to this project, correct, that you could sort of embody in some way this in-between space when you were exploring questions around issues about belonging and division, that it did have a personal resonance for you?
Because, yes, definitely.
You know, of your particular personal experiences.
Yeah.
Feeling somewhat of an outsider in this context.
Uh-huh. I think the Rolling Counterpoint itself, this tea house, especially the trailer tea house, is the almost embodiment of my identity.
And this is the trailer, the mobile tea house,
yes,
as opposed to the one that's installed at Montalvo,
right,
in Saratoga.
Mm-hmm. 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 Because we can move into the any place as an outsider and try to have conversation. And I think one of the reasons why I want to have conversation with people is that's what I feel in my everyday life as an immigrant and being an outsider.
And the project did come to life first at a residency that you had at Montalvo. Can either of you or both of you talk about that experience and how this idea came out of that residency?
And so we invited Taro to come and develop a work for our grounds as part of our annual Sculpture on the Grounds program. And, you know, we were interested in what kinds of ideas he might kind of develop and come up with.
Montalvo Art Center, the land was inherited from James Phelan. James Phelan is a famous figure in art world also. He gave so much money to the artists and art organizations. And he was a San Francisco mayor and also U.S. Senate. But also he was the big promoter of anti-Asian movement. So that rhetoric was very, very similar to what was going on in the 2016 election debate. And so that was the beginning.
And that's when you were in residency, was
in residency
during the campaign.
Yes, yes. And we came up with this, the use of idea of tea house, which is also historically very interesting, because tea house now looks like almost a representation of this beautiful, like, a Japanese culture. But it was a pretty political thing that time when it started, especially in the 16th century. So the tea masters used to invite political opponents into their tea houses to mediate the conversation and also to mitigate the tension they had. I wanted to kind of revive that function too, because that's what I had been doing, kind of getting these historical things into our contemporary context.
I'm wondering for each of you, just what you've been learning, what kind of new things have been occurring to you as this project has been going.
One thing I was really struck by was how many people want to participate in this. And there seems to be like a real desire to come and have a space to talk to someone. And I feel like it's by and large, been a very positive experience for the people who've participated. And it just feels like at this moment, we have there's a need to talk to one another, to have these spaces for conversation.
When I had conversation with especially with the Japanese Americans and also Muslim Americans, I started realizing how much of difficult time they're having because of the trauma their ancestors experienced. So this trauma experience is really cross-generational. And so they always talk about what their grandfather or grandmothers experienced and then how those influenced their lives. It's really changing the way I look at social problems and also political problems. And of course, how I look at myself too.
That was sculpture artist Taro Hattori and Montalvo curator Donna Conwell. Rolling Counterpoint's mobile tea house will be at both the Asian Art Museum and Latham Square in Oakland later this month. To learn more about all that, go to klw.org and click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Erica Demon was still a student at San Francisco's Academy of Art when she took the first picture that would become part of her first photography exhibit. The collection, which she slowly built over 2 years, is now showing at the Berkeley Art Museum. It's called Silhouettes, and it's a portrait series dedicated to African women in diaspora. KLW's Claire Strempel tells us more.
Erica Demon gasps as she walks into her solo exhibition for the first time.
My God. I mean, sometimes I have to pinch myself. It is actually the first time I've seen them all in a room together, all 30 pieces framed.
Larger-than-life portraits of Black women fill the walls.
So the show is about Black femininity. It is kind of guiding the audience to think about expectations and how we understand a person when we look at a face.
The images look similar from a distance because of the high contrast. In fact, they seem black and white. But move closer. It isn't until you're standing right up close that you can see color and definition. The highlights in a lock of hair, the specific curve of an eyelid, or the attitude and posture that makes each silhouette an individual person.
That's definitely my intention, is to kind of, on first glance, make people feel that they're looking at something that they've seen before and that may be black and white, for example, but then to kind of be drawn into the work and realize the individuality of all of the women.
Demon's heritage is Jamaican and English. Back in school, she wanted to shoot a portrait series connecting subjects from the African diaspora, people from around the world with African heritage. So she set up her camera, backdrop, and lights in a studio at school, and then...
I would literally go out onto the street and wait for women to walk past me that I believed were from the African diaspora or had one parent from the African diaspora.
Her breakthrough moment came when she saw a woman named Fatou Sek at a Mission District bar called Little Baobab. Demon invited her back to the academy to model for the project.
I saw her as a silhouette in my viewfinder. I just knew straight away that it was an important image for a woman of color to be within, because it was so kind of, it was really traditionally created for the European, for the white European. It gives me a chance to kind of go back and try and re-articulate all those words associated with features and characters such as strength and nobility, to kind of come back and give that to women of color and to Black women.
Demon works in a small, bright studio near the ballpark in San Francisco. Two portraits from the show dominate the metal wall across from her desk. One of the portraits is a woman with braids piled sculpturally on her head.
I project a peaceful and comfortable position.
Her eyes are cast down. Her lips are slightly parted. The two portraits are positioned so it looks like the women are looking at each other. The second portrait is a contrast to the serenity of the first.
I kind of half don't want to use the word of pride, but I feel that there is definitely a different presence and a pride within her positioning.
That woman is Ruby Rosas.
Well, I'm at a complete side profile. My eyes are looking completely straightforward. No, I'm not smiling, more stoic, but kind of more strong in a sense.
At the gallery, Rosas looks small standing next to her huge portrait. She laughs and confesses that under her stoic pose, she had some insecurities.
Well, to be very honest, I didn't wear deodorant that day, so I was like, I wonder if she can smell my pits. It's funny because at that point in my life, I was going through a lot of crazy, rough times. It was like a transitional place for me. It's like a pivotal, like, what are my next steps?
But she and Demon agree that strength is a running theme in the works.
In order to be a more liberated Black woman in this country, you don't have to be exactly angry or portray yourself as super angry. You can portray yourself as strong. You can portray yourself as still soft, but can still persevere.
Demon wants that strength to come through in her work because she says it has been underrepresented in the past.
You know, when you look at art history, you know, it's rare to see a Black woman in a position on the wall of power. You know, it's very clear that our position has maybe not been elevated or emphasized. So for me, I wanted to say, well, these women can be everything that everyone else can be on this planet.
She says that this work is important now, because society is still asking tough questions about how women and people of color are treated.
I mean, it feels very timely. And I think because the work pulls from art history, this is a vision for the future, for now and for the future.
Demon turns her attention to a photograph on the first wall of the exhibit.
I love this woman.
Her subject's face is luminous, her chin tilted up. As we get closer, we can see that her short hair is gray. Demon looks at the portrait and says she sees warmth, vulnerability.
Dignity and gravitas. She reminds me a little bit of my mom, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why it's a favorite of mine.
There's softness in her bare shoulders and the exposed nape of her neck, but resolve in her unwavering gaze that extends to some unknown place outside of the frame. In Berkeley, I'm Claire Strempel for Cross Currents.
Claire Strempel produced that story as a fellow in our Audio Academy training program. The Berkeley Art Museum is showing Demon's exhibit until Sunday. Find more information at klw.org and click Cross Currents. And that's all for us today. Our team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Jeremy Ju, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silber, Carrie Spivak, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff, and the line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien, and our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
If you leave, there's the door.
Today's local music is by Mike Rufo. You may have heard him on KALW's Saturday music programs like A Patchwork Quilt and Bluegrass Signal. Mike Rufo plays at the Haight-Ashbury Street Fair in San Francisco this Sunday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Baby, that's okay. But if you leave me now, down those tracks, ain't no hard feelings, but don't come back. And I don't want no letters telling me why. Save the postage, baby, just say goodbye. Oh, but do you really care if I'm here?